Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. ABC News is calling it Plan G. The Christian Science Monitor is calling it Plan D. It's this week's new attempt by BP to stop the oil gushing into the Gulf after acknowledgement that the top kill failed. And it could actually increase the flow of oil while trying to stop it. Wall Street Journal environmental reporter Jeffrey Ball has a quick update for us. And Jeffrey, this well is said to be spewing with the force of 7 fire hoses. Where are we at with this new plan?
What BP is now talking about trying is something called the Lower Marine Riser Plan, or LMRP. And essentially, as you alluded to, there have been a number of attempts to stop this already, none of which has worked. And now what BP is trying to do is essentially to cut off what's called the riser, the pipe that's rising up above this blowout preventer on this well, the device that failed, cut that off, and then put essentially a siphon over the cutoff pipe and pull the oil up to a surface where it would collect it. Now, you mentioned, Robin, that might increase the flow of oil, and the reason is this. There's currently a crimp in that pipe, and there's a sense that crimp may reduce the flow of oil, and so if you clean it up and remove that crimp, you may at least temporarily increase the flow of oil. But if this doesn't work, then obviously the number of options dwindles even further.
Well, Carol Brown of the White House Energy and Climate Change Advisor is saying it could temporarily increase the oil flow by 20%. It's kind of like unkinking a garden hose. It makes it worse. You know, the pressure the kink has been holding back comes out, makes it worse before it gets better. But BP is discounting the danger. They say this riser pipe is already so badly damaged, it's not kinked up. But we're reminded that this whole problem is leaks. It's not a full blowout, it's leaks. And staying with the garden hose analogy, when you tape over a leak, say with gaffer tape in your garden hose, you're in danger of blowing the whole hose, of increasing the pressure. Is that a danger with this well?
Well, the concern all along has been that potential remedies might worsen the situation. I mean, let's just remember, this is happening 5,000 feet below the surface in an environment of punishing temperatures and punishing pressures, which makes this whole operation unprecedented. I mean, there's a long list of ways in which this disaster is unprecedented, but one of them is that this is all occurring in an area where trying to fix it is particularly difficult. The other thing I think it's worth mentioning is that what's largely regarded as the ultimate solution here is a couple months off. If none of these attempts along the way works, then the likelihood is that the oil will continue gushing into the Gulf of Mexico through potentially August, at which point BP hopes to have successfully drilled 2 relief wells. And the notion is that these wells will go down and intersect the existing well, relieving pressure on the existing well and effectively cutting off the flow.
But Jeffrey Ball, people are really starting to talk long-term now. James Carville said today that when BP says the relief wells may be ready by August, they mean October. And we're hearing other scientists projecting oil spewing for up to 10 years. Do we know how much oil is in this pocket that BP has tapped?
There are estimates of the amount of oil that might be in this reservoir, but let's remember that this is already, according to the latest government estimates that came out last week, worse than the Valdez disaster. And this is already starting to wash up on shore. So, you know, the numbers are harrowing. And regardless of the operations offshore, what do people do in the meantime? While these operations are taking place offshore, oil is continuing to wash up in larger amounts onshore. All sorts of ecological questions about life onshore, animal life onshore, and also a range of sea life offshore. And that's a question that's only beginning to be investigated right now. But what people note here is that this is basically a new oil spill every day. And these droplets are sitting there long term, and the chronic effects of this on sea life are really just not understood.
Jeffrey Ball with the Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Taps at Arlington National Cemetery this morning. On this Memorial Day, we're asking a provocative question posed by military correspondent Tom Ricks. Does Mrs. Obama care more about vegetables than about soldiers' wives? Ricks recently blogged that despite making her concern for military families part of the presidential campaign, Michelle Obama still doesn't have a full-time aide for military family issues, but has found time for her campaign for healthy eating. And he pointed out that the administration promised military spouses tuition aid through a program called MyCAA and then restricted that aid. Well, if Rick's meant to be provocative, he succeeded. The column provoked the most response of any he'd ever posted. And afterwards, Michelle Obama spoke at the National Military Family Association Summit and announced that her husband has ordered a 90-day review to develop what the White House calls a coordinated federal government-wide approach to supporting and engaging military families. We're going to speak to military wives, but first, Tom Ricks. His blog in Foreign Policy magazine is called The Best Defense. Tom, do you think there's a connection between the First Lady's announcement about engaging military families and your blog?
I doubt it. There are a lot of military wives irate over the handling of the tuition assistance program, so I think they knew they had a problem even before I started writing about it.
Again, this was a program that offered this tuition assistance, and then when many, many spouses wanted to participate, they cut it back, and now they're restricting the program to just the people who are already enrolled. There can be no new applicants. Well, let's talk about some of the response after your first one-page blog. Some readers thought you were attacking the wrong person in attacking Michelle Obama. They said this is a Pentagon issue. Others said people in the military know what they're getting into. This isn't a draft. They get a paycheck. And you actually went back on and wrote back. What do you think these people were not getting?
Well, look, I'm an Obama fan, and I'm an admirer of the First Lady. Nonetheless, when politicians make promises, they should be held to them.
But why do you think spouses in particular are so important?
I think they are particularly important in an all-volunteer force. People forget that we are carrying out a huge military experiment here. This is the first time right now in our history that we've fought sustained wars overseas with an all-volunteer force. And it's worrisome to me because I think this may be the way the military breaks. We broke our military in the 1970s, but it was a draft military. We broke it basically by bringing a lot of people who didn't want to be there. You had a lot of drug addicts, a lot of violence, and a lot of racial tension in the military. That's not going to be the way the military breaks this time. If we break the military in the next 10 years, it's going to be because military wives and families are broken by the stress and strain of these deployments after deployments after deployments. We are fighting a 1% war in this country. 1% of the people in this country are involved in it, while the other 99% of the country has very little to do with it.
Well, Tom Ricks, Michelle Obama actually mentions that in her speech to the National Military Families Association Summit. And she goes on to say that her husband's administration has increased pay and benefits and career development for spouses, extended Family Medical Leave Act to families and caregivers, and signed into law legislation expanding veterans' health care. But obviously they feel there's more to be done because they've launched this review.
Well, I never said she was stupid. I just said she hadn't followed up on some things. Clearly they understand that there's a difference between making promises and carrying them out. This was emphasized recently by Defense Secretary Gates when he was speaking at Fort Riley, Kansas. And he said, the funny thing is, at the Pentagon, they tell me about all the great programs we're giving military families. When I go out to the bases, the wives tell me where are the programs. There is a disconnect there between things that have been announced and things that have been delivered. And that's what this review is about.
Tom, you asked a question at the end of your blog. It's very provocative. How many soldiers' wives committed suicide last year? What's the answer?
I don't know, which is why I put it out there. I'm told the Pentagon has the number but hasn't released it. It intrigues me that the numbers seem to be collected but are not being released.
Tom Ricks, Senior Fellow, Center for a New American Security, and contributing editor at Foreign Policy Magazine, author of Fiasco and The Gamble About Iraq. And as we said, he has a blog at Foreign Policy Magazine, which has caused quite a reaction. Tom, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, let's bring in Rebecca Noah Pointer. She's an Army wife. She's a writer, co-founder of the Military Spouse Business Association, and she is the woman that Tom asked to respond to comments on his blog. She joins us from the studios of NPR member station KERA in Dallas. Well, Rebecca, what did you say to people? What don't you think they get?
Well, we've had 16 months with First Lady Michelle Obama, but we've had what I would call ceremonial support. We've had photo ops. We've had invitations to the White House, to White House events. But the very first event that the Washington Post calls tangible, which was a speech in January to military spouses, the educational program that she announced was canceled 3 weeks later. And it just indicates a lack of overall understanding and grasp of what's happening within the military community.
This is the tuition assistance program. And as we said, it was to offer tuition assistance for spouses. So many spouses applied that they cut it off and only allowed those already enrolled to be in the program.
Right. That was a two-year program. And if you look at the numbers, the amount dedicated really allows less than 5% of spouses to participate.
Okay, but what do you say to people who say, and in fact, we might hear that in a moment from another military spouse, that that's not her fault. You know, that's the Pentagon's fault. Are you saying that she should have fought more, that she should have somehow reversed that?
I think she should have had a staff member go over the speech and say, is this really happening? Is this fully funded? By dedicating a staff member, that staff member is able to have a way to follow up.
So you agree with Tom Ricks that she needs a full-time staffer dedicated to issues of military families.
It would be great if it were a military spouse, and it would be great if it wasn't a colonel's wife. Let's see a captain's wife, somebody who's on the front line and can really talk about what's out there.
Why is it so much more important at this time in history that military spouses have access to tuition assistance?
Well, 50% of military spouses work, but because they move every 2 to 3 years based on their individual situation, their overall ability to keep employment is reduced. And that was the concept behind offering career enhancement with the MyCAA account.
Talk to us about how much military families move, because that's another issue. You had long been looking for legislation that gives spouses a home state. Explain what that is.
Since World War II, the service member has been guaranteed a home state, have a driver's license, vote, register property from the same state. And that was never guaranteed for the spouse.
That sounds incredible to us. So the military member, man or woman, if they're moved around on different bases in the U.S., they get to keep their home state licensing and all of that sort of stuff that takes so much time. But the spouse that travels with them doesn't?
They didn't till about 5 months ago.
That's incredible.
Right. That was a spouse-initiated grassroots effort. Probably the first time that there had been something that wasn't a change that came to us because of the DOD saying, we'd like to change this for you. It wasn't a change that came any other way other than spouses saying, hey, this is ridiculous. There's a flattened communication sense now with Facebook, and spouses are able to communicate with each other, and that's part of a change. You're no longer going to have the silent military family, because guess what? We can make our opinions known. We can find others in the same situation to see if there is something that needs to be changed and improved. And I think that's fabulous.
That's military spouse Rebecca Noah Pointer. She runs a business association for military spouses. You know what? We have a couple more questions for Rebecca. We also want to know more about the provocative thought from Tom Ricks. You know, is military spouse suicide a bigger problem than we know? So let's take a break, and we'll continue in 1 minute. Later today, why we even have this day, back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. Military correspondent Tom Ricks recently made the provocative claim that if the military breaks, it will be because spouses have had it. And he said First Lady Michelle Obama should hire a full-time aide on spousal issues to make sure that promises like tuition support are carried through. Before the break, we were speaking with military spouse Rebecca Noah Pointer, who agrees that Michelle Obama should take more of a lead. She doesn't agree with Tom Ricks that the military is in danger of breaking, because she says military spouses have found a new voice. You know, 14,000 of them celebrated recent advances on their Facebook page. But Rebecca, I just want to make sure we asked you about criticism of you that we're reading on Tom's blog. What do you say to people who say you and others are critical of Michelle Obama because it's political? You just don't like her.
Oh, I do like Michelle Obama, and I think she's somebody that military spouses can really relate to. We're the same age. She's got a degree. She's not currently working. She lives in government housing. She's got two kids that she has to provide for. Her husband's often out of town. They have to go to a lot of government events. throughout the military community, I think spouses look at her and certainly can relate to her.
But you want her to follow through.
I want her to follow through. Yeah. Less ceremonial and more real advocacy.
That's Rebecca Noah Poynter, an Army wife, writer, co-founder of the Military Spouse Business Association. Rebecca, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, let's bring in another Rebecca, Rebecca Sanderlin, who writes the blog Operation Marriage for the Fayetteville Observer and joins us from NPR member station WFSS at Fayetteville State University in North Carolina. Rebecca, welcome back. And your thoughts on criticism of First Lady Michelle Obama?
Well, you know, I think she's limited in what she actually can do, and where some of the others would criticize her for having only given ceremonial support to military spouses, I would say that she's given passionate ceremonial support, and I think that that's good enough. I don't expect her to create policy. I don't even think that would be appropriate.
What are some of the things that she's done that have resonated for you?
Initially, just in the campaign, when she, it seemed like out of the blue to me, came out and said that she wanted to make military spouses one of her focuses, that alone was a huge step. And then right after the inauguration, she was here in Fayetteville. I mean, it was like within 2 months. She had a big meeting with military spouses on Fort Bragg, and then she had a meeting in the community that I attended later that day to talk about how the White House could reach out to military spouses.
Well, and then this is interesting because for you, this is something of a conversion. You write that you were a John McCain supporter. In fact, you took your then little baby girl to a rally and your daughter was wearing a drill baby drill pin. And you write that's how much you opposed President Obama. But what? I mean, what have they both done that's made you feel that they get you?
Well, you know, I'm still not a fan of President Obama's policies. I believe that as community organizers, they are amazing. I think that they both have reached out to my community, to the military family community, in a way that I've never seen before. One example of that would be the Fatherhood Forum that was again here in Fayetteville just recently.
This is President Obama's initiative to explore the role of fathers in troubled settings.
Right. And there was an entire day devoted to that, open to the public here in Fayetteville with White House representatives. And to me, that's huge.
But on the other hand, what we're hearing really in this discussion about Michelle Obama is some of the issues facing military spouses. What do you think the Pentagon is overlooking?
Well, first, I don't think the Pentagon is overlooking anything. I truly don't think that the problem is a lack of programs. I think that there's a lack of coordination within programs and implementation. But I really would pin the shortfall on the American public. And I'm not saying that in a blame sense. I don't think the American public has been brought into the fight. And I think that that's where the disconnect is.
This is something Michelle Obama mentioned in her summit. Less than 1% of Americans who are carrying out two wars. The war in Afghanistan is now over 1,000 Americans killed. What would you want to see Americans do?
You know, I think it's almost psychological involvement. I don't even know how to phrase that better. I want to see Americans notice. There's not much awareness that the war is even still going.
In Rebecca Poynter's column on Tom Rick's blog, she said that Michelle Obama, during the campaign, suggested that Americans take military spouses to lunch for Military Spouse Appreciation Day. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about, literal interaction? Or
I think any gesture. A few years ago, and Michelle Obama mentioned this in her recent speech, the Fayetteville Cares program hosted a baby shower for military moms.
And a thousand of them.
1,000, right. It was amazing. I was there. That was one thing. There's a car dealership here in town that occasionally will sponsor free child care.
She also mentioned the Sierra Club, which has helped launch summer camps for thousands of military kids. But, Rebecca, what do you say to people, and we're reading them on Tom Rick's blog, who say, this is a different military. This is like a job. Military families knew what they were getting into, and they're getting a paycheck for it.
Well, you know, that's a really hurtful thing to hear. Yeah. Because it's not just a job. You know, it truly is a commitment to continually sacrifice our own best interest in order to help out our country.
Well, one last thing. Tom Ricks asks a very provocative question. How many military spouse suicides are there? He says the Pentagon has a number and won't release it. You have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't know the number either. I know what I see. And I know that in April, I kept the children of a good friend for a week so that she could get treatment for being suicidal. She's a military spouse. And we spent hours on the phone trying to figure out how to get her treatment. Once she was in a mental facility, one of the psychiatrists treating her told us that most of his patients are military spouses for being suicidal. I agree wholeheartedly with Tom Ricks. I think he is 100% on point with all of the issues he raises. I don't think it's Michelle Obama's fault, but I think that he is 100% right that this will be the issue that breaks our military.
That's Rebecca Sanderlin, an Army wife who writes the blog Operation Marriage for the Fayetteville Observer. We also spoke with Rebecca Noah Pointer, another Army wife, and military correspondent Tom Ricks. Rebecca Sanderlin, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Israel's prime minister is canceling his White House visit tomorrow to deal with a new crisis, that raid by Israeli naval commandos today that killed at least 10 pro-Palestinian activists aboard a ship and a flotilla that was attempting to bypass an Israeli blockade and bring aid to Palestinians in Gaza. There's video and sound aboard that ship. Let's listen.
Stop your resistance. They are using live ammunition.
Israel's defense minister expressed regret for the deaths, but blamed the violence on provocation from the activists. The aid mission was sponsored in part by a Turkish group. Turkey has been an ally to Israel, but the Turkish prime minister is now calling the assault state terrorism. The six ships from the flotilla are being towed to the Israeli port city of Ashdod. The BBC's Chloe Hajmathew is there. Chloe, what are you seeing there?
Hi Robin, I'm actually on a hill overlooking Ashdod Harbour. It's a very big harbour. I can see lots of cranes below me and lots of shipping containers. And a little earlier I was on the other side of the port from where I could see three big white tents. They've been erected in preparation for processing all these activists. At the moment, we have three ships from the six-ship flotilla, which have been towed back to Ashdod Harbour. Those activists on board will be processed. They'll then be deported from Israel. And the Israelis say that the goods on board the ship, which were bound for Gaza, will still be processed and sent to Gaza.
Well, we have been hearing about this flotilla for about a week now. They are with the Free Gaza Movement. This is the ninth time they've tried to ship aid to Gaza since 2008. Israelis saying, no, you can't ship it directly to Gaza. You have to come through our port. And we understand that while they've pledged to send the aid on, they've always said they would not send any of the items that they also block from Gaza, things like cement, I believe.
That's right. Cement is actually banned from entering Gaza. And I think even the Israeli government acknowledges that the situation in Gaza, although they say there's no humanitarian crisis, they will acknowledge that the situation there is by no means easy. And that's quite deliberate because, as you know, an Israeli soldier, Gilad Shalit, has been held in Gaza for several years now. And the Israeli government want to make life quite difficult under a Hamas government in Gaza in order to try and persuade them to release this soldier. So that's one of the reasons that they banned certain goods. Other reasons are that they're afraid they may be used to create some sort of attack on Israel. You know that Hamas fighters have been sending rockets into Israel. So Israel doesn't want to make life easy in Gaza at all, and they also want to protect their citizens, so they have embargoed certain goods from being allowed into Gaza.
Well, what happened today, Chloe? We have two versions. An Israeli official saying the commandos were forced by violent activists on board the ship to respond with live fire. A reporter on the boat saying the Israelis fired at the vessel before even boarding it. Do we know what happened?
It's very hard to get a straight story. There are two sides to this, and it may be some time before we actually find out what did actually take place. As we heard earlier there, you played some clips from on board the ship. The Israeli military recorded some of their actions on board the ship, and the footage actually shows it's taken from the helicopters from which the Israeli commandos were winched down and landed on board these ships. What we can see in the footage, it's not very clear, it's quite grainy. grainy, but we do see a commando being lowered onto the deck of the ship, and then it looks like he's surrounded by the activists on board. The Israeli military say that the activists were armed with metal rods, with slingshots, and with knives, and the Israeli military claim that they were attacked. They also say that the activists tried to take away their weapons. One soldier, they claim, was shot with his own gun by an activist who took it from his hands and shot him in the stomach. And they say that it was only after they felt that their lives were under threat that they decided to make the very difficult decision to use live ammunition. And that's when activists were killed. We know that at least 10 were killed. Some figures have them up to 19 dead. There's no accurate figure at the moment. We know there's at least 10 and many others injured.
That's the BBC's Chloe Hadjimatheou in Israel. Chloe, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Of course, we'd always love to hear your thoughts on this or any other story. Just go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us, or you can scroll down and leave a comment right there. Quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, the ethics of egg donor agencies. Back in 30 seconds, Here and Now. Welcome back. Well, one meaning of Memorial Day is the beginning of summer, and for many people that means firing up the grill. But if the idea of burgers, even tofu dogs, does not thrill you, might we suggest a grilled Greek salad? That was the brainchild of our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, a couple summers back. It was a crowd favorite. She came to the deck of our mothership, WBUR, here in Boston, to show us how it's done. So, Kathy, grilling, how appropriate. What shall we start with?
Well, I actually was sitting in a restaurant the other day having a Greek salad, thinking how it was so boring, but that I loved all the individual elements of it. So one of the things about grilling is that when you put things on at the same time, you know, like people make shish kebabs and they do the meat and the veggies and on, nothing cooks at the right time. So I thought, what if you deconstructed the whole salad?
A Greek salad?
A Greek salad. We are going to grill chicken, we're going to grill peppers, onions, we're going to grill olives, we're even going to grill feta cheese. So all the great elements of the salad, but on individual kebab skewers so that each one can cook perfectly and you're not competing like, oh wait, I think the chicken's done but the vegetable's not. And also for people like you that don't eat meat, you have a whole meal of vegetables, but you also have the meat and it's separate, so you can please many different types of people in one barbecue.
Well, I just can't wait to see the feta cheese grilling part.
Yeah, that's kind of cool.
Get us started. What do we do?
Okay,
here?
The very first thing is, mm-hmm. It's like a garden. You have to prepare the soil. You have to prepare your grill. Okay, so the first step is to clean it. So you want to take a good brush. These are very inexpensive. And you want to scrub off the grill piece so that you don't have any pieces from your last barbecue there, because that's going to cause food to stick and then get in trouble. Mm-hmm. Now, the next thing is, the most important thing is it hot enough? Here's how you tell. Ready? Put your hand over the grill. If I can keep my hands, here you go, 6 inches above, you're at low. But that's hot, right? Go lower. 1 inch too hot, it's perfect.
So if at 1 inch that's too hot, that's good.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have a skewer here with red onions. See, this is what I was talking about. Some things take longer than others, so we'll start with the red onions. And then I also have chicken that I've marinated in olive oil, lemon juice, oregano, and a little mint. But these are all the flavors, very Mediterranean, very Greek. And again, I'm keeping these separate. In fact, I'm going to move it over so that your veggies don't touch my chicken. Some people are picky about this. You're welcome. But this is called direct grilling, where you have a hot, high heat. You put the food directly on it. There's also something called indirect grilling, where you get hot charcoals. You move them to one side. Half of your grill is cool. Half of your grill is hot. And with things like ribs, you want to put it on the indirect side. Okay. So what we've got here is a skewer with red onions on it. We've got our chicken that I told you I marinated. Then I have beautiful orange and red and yellow peppers. We'll put those on. And then I also took green pimento-filled olives.
This is so funny.
Turns out that they get a very smoky, delicious flavor. And a hot grilled olive you're going to see is something fabulous.
Okay.
And then I have cherry tomatoes. Any tomato that's on the vine, the cherry tomatoes, the grape tomatoes are all fine. One of the huge problems with food right now is the cost. And grilling is a great opportunity. You can take advantage of lesser cuts. That's what they call it. It seems so rude. But cuts of meat and chicken that aren't that popular.
Like what? Name some.
Okay, skirt steak is a fabulous example. Skirt steak's very inexpensive. It's a long, thin piece. It's got some natural fat in it. And if you marinate it in some fresh ginger and a little soy and maybe a rice wine vinegar and throw it on the grill, it will be every bit as exquisite, if not better, than your thick T-bone steak that traditionally was served. Even with chicken, thighs are half the price of breasts. Thighs and dark meat have a lot more flavor and a lot more juice. They don't dry out as much. So these are just little things you can do.
Now, I want to note, Kathy, that your skewers are like
ancient.
Aren't
they dazzling?
They're fantastic. They've got handles with, looks like, dancing men on them.
I know. I don't even remember where I got them. I've had them for years. You certainly don't need fancy metal skewers, although what I like about metal skewers is you don't throw them out each time and
right.
they last.
But if you do use the wooden skewers, what should we know beforehand?
There's very inexpensive bamboo skewers here with little pointy tips. You must soak them in water first. Otherwise, think about it. You're putting a very thin piece of wood on a hot, hot flame and it will just burn up. Also, you might notice I'm using tongs. These are fairly inexpensive little tongs. Well, the worst thing you can do when you're grilling foods is to stab it with a fork. What happens is all the juices come out and it dries up on the grill. So tongs allow you to turn things over like this without even touching the food, really, and nothing is pierced and nothing, you're not going to lose any precious juices. Okay, here is a little trick too. I have a tiny little cup here of olive oil with a little pastry brush. You could use a spoon, and I'm going to just dip it on the food because I want to keep these veggies nice and moist.
And to remind people, we have the skewer of red onions chopped into wedges. We have the panels of peppers, yellow and orange, on another skewer, and you've got the marinated chicken on another. And hooboy, it's really smoking.
It's getting smoky.
Now, yeah.
But here's an even better tip. Particularly for people who are like watching calories, which so many people do in the summer, and they're thinking, I don't want to brush my food with olive oil. Take a lemon or a lime if you're grilling a piece of fish and squeeze it directly onto the vegetables. And it's like a lubricant. I mean, it just keeps them very juicy and gives them that fresh lemony flavor. So what I did with the feta cheese, I lightly brushed cubes about 2 inches long of feta cheese from a block with a tiny bit of olive oil, and then I coated them in panko breadcrumbs, which is a Japanese breadcrumb. It's very coarse. And what that's going to do is protect it. I'm going to put it right on the heat there.
Just laying the blocks of feta cheese
directly
on.
So you think, why isn't it just melting? They're very well chilled. We're going to put our tomatoes on. We're going to do the olives last. And I'm going to put the tomatoes on the side because they don't need a ton of heat. It's really that chicken that needs the most heat. So if we've got our feta going, our tomatoes, our olives, our chicken, and our peppers, we've got our Greek salad. This would be beautiful served on a bed of fresh garden lettuce. You could serve it with pita bread or yogurt. Yogurt with some garlic and olive oil and lemon, and it would be a delicious sauce with this.
The olives on the skewer just went on. That is so funny.
Here, I'm going to just do a little bit of olive oil right on the olives so we get a double olive flavor. And notice our tomatoes are starting to soften. They'll blister. Ooh, it's getting smoky. And as soon as they soften, they're ready to come off. And then we have a whole meal here, and you just pull it off the skewers and give everybody a hunk of pita bread. And it's a really beautiful Mediterranean grilled summer meal.
Here and Now's resident chef, Kathy Gunst. Her two latest cookbooks are Stonewall Kitchen Grilling and Stonewall Kitchen Appetizers. And to see her recipe for grilled Greek salad, oh, it's so good, go to our website, hereandnow.org. And by the way, let's set the table for the rest of this week. Some stories coming up. Geek Alert, we'll hear about the passion of debate clubs. Robert Reich will be here to talk about financial reform. And we'll meet disabled actor Zach Weinstein. That's all this week. In a minute, a Vietnam vet reflects on this day, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. Of course, it's Memorial Day. Veterans across the country participating in ceremonies in cemeteries where many of their fellow troops are buried.
These young men and women that we send off as a nation to fight for our freedom, the ones who don't come home, I want people to always remember them, not just on Memorial Day. It's not about a sale at the store. This is about young men and women who have given their very lives for our freedom.
That's Vietnam vet J. Richard Watkins. He earned more than a dozen medals for his combat service with the 25th Army Infantry during the Vietnam War. He was a radio operator for a unit known as the Wolfhounds, calling in artillery support for troops as they fought along the Cambodian border in 1969 and 70. When Richard Watkins came home, he put the medals away and got a job. Didn't really think about the war all that much, but over time, when the memories of his Vietnam experience began to tug at him, he decided to start writing them down. The result is his book, Vietnam, No Regrets, One Soldier's Tour of Duty. Here now's Alex Ashlock met up with Richard recently in the Veterans section of the Melrose Cemetery here in Brockton, Massachusetts.
Now, you joined the Army, I think, right after high school graduation. I think you had a desk job for a year, and you volunteered to go to combat.
I did. I was in Fort Riley, Kansas. I looked at my circumstances, and I really thought about it, and I said, you know, I don't want to miss this. I did not want to miss Vietnam. I was in the Army. I was trained to do for a combat role. I only felt it was fair being 21, single, and I wanted to go anyway. To survive it was a feat in itself. There were days that I didn't think I was going to survive. There were days I didn't plan on surviving. I was just taking one day at a time and saying my prayers and really hoping for the best.
Why do you think you did survive? You were often in helicopter assaults, and you and two other soldiers were actually thrown out of your helicopter on one of those assaults, and the helicopter left and left you guys in the grass. Why do you think you survived?
Yeah, there's not an answer. I don't have an answer.
I mean, were you just lucky?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I tell, when I'm out talking to students in groups, I fully explain to them that there was just a lot of luck involved. When you're walking a trail on the Cambodian border and you walk left and you walk right and there for the grace of God, go I. It's a lot of luck involved. And I challenge John Wayne himself to be able to spot a fishing line hooked to a grenade on the ground, and you can see it. You can't see it. There's a lot of luck involved.
I guess I was a little surprised. You do talk about men getting wounded and killed, obviously, in battle, but it's not graphic.
I want 12-year-olds to read this book. I want 14-year-olds to read this book. I don't think it would serve a purpose to be graphic with violence and the blood and the trauma of what it's like to witness someone being shot or blown up. I can leave it up to your imaginations to really picture what it's like. And every time when I would get into a situation where I have to tell you what's going to happen next, that part of the book may take me, took me months. It took me 4 years to put this out because I'd go back to it. And then I wouldn't want to go back to it. Then I don't want to visit there anymore because I'd have to bring up some serious, serious memories that I buried for a long time. My mother had kept all my letters, so I reread all my letters. I had a bunch of pictures, and I actually made a trip down to the National Archives in Washington and looked up a few incidences that I believed happened, and sure enough, there they are. Yeah, they're recorded down there, so it was very important for me to put this book out like that, too.
You got some excellent advice early on, maybe soon after you landed in Vietnam from Lieutenant Baker.
He came over to me one morning and he said, you know, he asked me, he said, Richard, you know, do you really want to survive, you know, Vietnam? And, you know, I'm there, well, yeah, of course I do. He said, no, I'm going to talk about really surviving here now. And now I knew he was getting a little deeper into his thought. And his advice to me, and it stayed with me throughout my year, was if you really want to survive, then you have to leave it here. You're going to do a lot of things in the coming year that you're not going to be particularly proud of. But if you don't leave it here, and you take it home with you, then you're going to continuously fight this war forever. And you're not going to win. It's going to beat you finally at the end. And I thought about that. And I said, well, okay, I'll put that aside. It's kind of an old guy. I'm 21. He was probably 30, you know. But when I got to the end of my tour and I was looking at the, actually on the tarmac, looking at the plane, And I said, you know, he's right. You got to stay here. And I literally looked at myself and said, you're staying. I'm going home. I'm going home, and I'm going to be, I'm not going to take you with me. I can't take all the baggage with me, what I did to get here. And that served me well. It did. It was a great piece of advice.
There's no politics in the book. You don't write about whether Vietnam was a good war, bad war. But I'm wondering, we're just passing the 40th anniversary of the shootings at Kent State. I'm wondering how aware you were when you were in Vietnam of the protests that were going on here in the States.
You know, I was very aware of it. Yeah, and we were.
I wondered why you didn't write about that.
The politics of it really weren't, it wasn't up to me. It was really my position, and my job was to serve my country and survive it. And you're doing an interview with someone who was actually, in August of 68, I was at a place called Grant Park, Chicago, during the Democratic National Convention. So I was going left or going right or going left, and finally I said, you know, I'm going to go right. I'm going to serve my country, and that's that. Because I only had really one goal in mind when I wrote the book, and the goal really ultimately was to have you be by my side, get to know me, but more so, get to know really what Vietnam was really like. I never slept in a bed for a year. I always slept on the ground. Everything I had, I carried. I want people to know that side, that soldier. I was in Connecticut not long ago, and I was doing a book signing, and a lady came up to me. She wanted to purchase the book as a gift for her husband for Christmas, but she didn't know if he'd read it, because he never talks about his time in Vietnam. And she goes, well, I'll tell you what. I'm going to buy it, and I'm going to wrap it up. I'm going to give it to him, but if he doesn't read it, I'm going to read it. Because I want to know more about it. And I want to know more about it through the soldier's eyes. I don't want to know about Vietnam through the general's eyes. I want an everyday person. She purchased the book. I had an opportunity back in Connecticut in February. And I looked up, and sure enough, this lady was standing in front of me. And she came up, and she said, I want you to know, your book was the best Christmas present that I've ever given my husband. Because now he read it, and I read it. And for the first time in 40 years, he is now talking about his experience in Vietnam, because he knows that now I can understand what he's talking about. That was the bridge. She came around the table, and she gave me a big hug, and she whispered to me, and she said, thanks. You know, you've done a wonderful thing, and I really appreciate it. That's the lady and her husband that I wrote the book for.